Morning. We're a small group this morning. I try to keep this talk rather informal, although I have some prepared thoughts and prepared ideas. But if you have any questions or interjections or comments that you'd like to make during the talk, please feel free to raise your hand and we can have more dialogue if that's what wants to happen. So I said I would talk about some stories from our Chinese Zen ancestors. And one thing we find in those stories is a lot of animals. There's a lot of animals that come up in the old stories. Cows and cats and lions and tigers and foxes. The old stories are replete with those metaphors of various animals. And but today I said I would talk about donkeys and oxes, or oxen. Maybe donkeys and oxen are two of the most popular animal partners of the old masters. As metaphors for our mind, those animals, donkeys and oxen, are rather known for being rather, they have a reputation, I think, that's survived through many, I think, you know, goes back to Aesop's fables and other writings like that, where those animals get a reputation for being stubborn and lazy and hard to bend to the human will. Animals that like to just do things their own way. So as a metaphor for the kind of wild and untrainable aspect of our mind, our uncontrollable, seemingly uncontrollable aspect of our mind, they fit that stubborn quality that is resistive to training and control. They can be understood that way. Some of the stories, and the story that I will bring up, I think they kind of have that stereotype about the donkey and the ox. And I think they have that stereotype in the background, but actually the foreground of the story is more about training the mind and some success working with the mind and making it coming into harmony with the mind. So the protagonist of this first story is Baijong Weihai, a very famous Zen master of the Tang Dynasty era. And Baijong was a student of the incomparably renowned Matsu Daoyi, or Joshu in Japanese. Excuse me. and Baijong is you know famous in his own right, and he is credited with establishing the ethos in Chinese Zen monasteries that the monasteries should be self-supporting through work and through growing crops and through the labor of the monks in the fields and in the monastery grounds, that the monastery should not this is a different model than India, where the monks were just supposed to be supported by they didn't work and they would just be supported by the population. They were just like that. And but in China, that kind of model didn't really comport with the ethic the ethic of the society. So Baijong introduced this idea of the monks and the monasteries being self-supporting to the greatest extent possible. And he is also established the monastic rule. So the rule, the way the monastery was organized, the various jobs within the monastery. And Dogen looked very much back at Baijong in when he established the Eihei Shingi, which is the rules he developed for Japanese Soto Zen monasteries. There's a famous story about Baijong that when he established this work ethic essentially in the Chinese monasteries, and he was part of that, and he would go out into the fields or on the monastic grounds and do work with the monks. And as he got older, his monks became concerned that he was overdoing it. So one day they decided to hide his tools so he couldn't go into the fields. And upon not being able to retrieve his tools, Baijong refused to eat. And so after that, the saying was attributed to him, "A day without work is a day without food." That was part of Baijong's strictness. So this story that I want to tell about Baijong, it's a famous story about Baijong and the fox, which some people may know that story, but this is a different story. And this is a story of his interaction with his student, Da'an. So I'll just read this story. When Da'an met Baijong, he bowed and asked, "This student seeks to know Buddha. How can I do so?" Baijong said, "It's like riding an ox looking for an ox." Da'an said, "After finding it, then what?" Baijong said, "It's like riding the ox and arriving home." Da'an then asked, "How does one ultimately uphold and sustain this?" Baijong said, "It's like an ox herd who, grasping his staff, watches the ox so that he doesn't transgress by eating other people's sprouts and grains." Upon receiving this instruction, Da'an sought nothing further. That's pretty good. He didn't need any other instruction. That was good enough for Da'an. I wonder if it's good enough for us. So, yeah, I think this is a really rich story, and it gets right to the heart of the matter. he wants to get to know Buddha. Daan wants to get to know Buddha. So Baijiang gives him this, he doesn't give him like, well, here's how to get to know Buddha. He just says, it's like riding the ox, looking for the ox, or searching for the ox. So I think in our, you know, this kind of absurd statement, you know, if you're riding the ox, you know, you should know where the ox is, right? Shouldn't be much of a search there. You're right there with the ox. And of course, you know, that's the point. I mean, well, maybe there's two points. One of the points is that even though we're writing this, we're in this mind, we have this mind, we're you know, not necessarily in sync or in harmony with this mind, and we have some feeling, and it extends into our practice that I'm not very satisfied with this mind. And one of the reasons I'm not satisfied with this mind is that it's doing things that aren't that I didn't ask it to do. I didn't ask it to think these thoughts. It just seems to have a mind of its own. The mind that has a mind of its own. And so when we sit down to practice, this is, you know, we have some intent to have, you know, a certain kind of mind. You know, we would like to have, in our practice, we would like to have a calm, settled mind that is not, completely submerged in thought objects, you know, the objects of thought. That's the kind of mind we've been told to produce, actually, right? In our produce this kind of mind. Produce a calm mind. Produce a kind mind. Produce a relaxed mind. But, you know, so we kind of have a feeling that's our job here, doing sitting meditation, to have that kind of a mind. But as we find out, the best way to have that kind of mind is to have the mind that we have, is to notice and be aware of the mind that's just arising now, not a mind that's trying to be a particular way, but just being open to receiving the mind we have now. And let me tell you, I mean, a lot of times I think I would rather not have this particular mind that I have right now. I'm riding this ox, and this is a terrible ox. I should sell this ox. It's just an awful, uncooperative, stubborn, willful ox, and I should sell it and get another one. Get a more compliant ox. It will do what I ask it to do, for goodness sake. But as we know, as it pertains to the metaphor, we don't have that choice. You know, you can't trade in this body and mind that you have. The one you have is the one you have. And our teaching is to settle in this one you have right now. And that's the most direct way to arrive home, because that's what Baijong said, not next, says next. He says, after finding, you know, Da'an says, after finding this ox, okay, maybe that means after accepting that I just have the mind that I have right now, and let me just see if I can say, okay, this mind is very distracted. It's really, you know, not doing what I wish it would do, but this is nevertheless, this is what I've, This is the conditions that I'm experiencing. So let me just embrace. Let me just harmonize with this actual mind. Just look directly into this mind that is doing whatever it's doing. So that's kind of, if you're willing, that kind of willingness to do that, to look at the mind you have, is kind of like finding the ox, you know, the willingness to just look at the mind you have. And you know, this is kind of like, you know, it's kind of like being naked or something like that. Just look at the actual, just as it's presenting itself. Without any thought that it should be different, that it should be there should be a different condition arising. So it's kind of this, you know, I can't quite find the word, but it's kind of this. Just looking, you know, it's like I said, naked, but like raw. Just look at the raw mind, you know, just as it is, in its non-ideal condition. If that effort is sustained, there can be a shift. You know, there will be a shift. There will be a turning. And you know, this is the kind of faith that this is where a kind of faith in our practice and this, you know, this ancient lineage of sitting meditation practice. To have faith that, you know, just looking at this willful, stubborn self is enough. And then somehow, persisting in that, you arrive home. And arriving home, there's a shift and it moves in the direction that you wanted to go. You wanted to go in the direction of harmony. You wanted to go in the direction of calming. You wanted to go in the direction of bringing forth a kind mind, a compassionate mind, a caring mind, a mind that cares for yourself and for other people. You wanted to go in that direction. You didn't know how. You were just willing to look at the mind you had that wasn't like that. And that made all the difference, that willingness. So at the then at the end of this story, it says, Da'an is impressed, apparently. He says, how does one ultimately uphold and sustain this? And Baijong said, it's like an ox herd who, grasping his staff, watches the ox so that he doesn't transgress by eating other people's sprouts and grain. So, you know, this is like Bodhisattva vow, right? This is the Bodhisattva vow. Um, And the Bodhisattva vow, first though, it's based on taking care of yourself. And if you really take care of yourself, if you really take care of your own ox, then, you know, you will be satisfied and you won't be looking to get your needs met by other people. You won't be needing to eat other people's sprouts and grain. You become satisfied with the body and mind that you have, and you watch any tendencies to, you know, exploit anybody else's fields. You really, really become careful about that. And then, you know, you don't need to seek it like dawn. You don't need to seek anything further. You just need to endlessly keep an eye on the ox and make sure, and just because it's your practice, you will carefully prevent any transgressing in other people's business and other people's goods and other people's fields. And you might see some arising of a transgression, but you'll cut it off as you become more practiced. You have that ability to say, you pull on the rope, say, no, don't go there. Come over here in where my grass is. You can have this grass, and I kindly give you as much of this as you want, but don't go messing with other folks'. Good hearts. Don't crush other people's sprouts and grain. And that too becomes something that feeds you, right? Feeds you. When you see yourself being careful, not transgressing, that feeds you. You feel good about yourself. You feel, oh, I caught that. That thought arose, or that kind of impulse arose, but I didn't say anything. I didn't do anything. I looked at what was, I evaluated first, and I said, well, would that be skillful to say right now? Or maybe you do say something, right? But you say it in a different way. You, because you've checked, you've given a little tug on the rope there, and you say, how can I say that in a way that I think won't be a transgression on this person, who won't be hurtful or sort of tamp them down or in some way. And then you change the way you speak, or maybe you don't speak at all. Maybe you just say, is that so? You become stronger, right? Become stronger in a gentle and loving way. So this is, this is Bodhisattva activity, but it comes from, our searching for the ox, our not finding it, even though we're riding on it. But yet, somehow, arriving home, doing the work that we have to do so we can arrive home. So there's another story from the Book of Serenity, and this one is about, oh, Larry has a hand up. Please.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Jim. You know, I have had two thoughts about that story. And the first one is, I think it's a traditional Zen saying or some commentary about even a three-year-old can understand it, but it takes 80 years or more to realize. I mean, one can understand, well, don't, you know, just accept your own mind as it is. It's easy to say that to yours. It's easy to say it, and it's harder to realize it. That can take a lifetime or more. So I think this story kind of points to that. That was my first thought. My second thought was, I like your, you know, commentary or interpretation on the oxen eating the neighbor's greens as far as the way you interpret it as a transgression. You know, if you have the mind of Buddha, you will not, naturally there will be no desire to transgress or interfere with the other person's, you know, life. But when I heard you talk, give the story, I had a different interpretation. I don't know. Maybe there's two interpretations or more. But the way I initially thought was, with the mind of Buddha, your own mind has no need to eat the food that sustains another's thoughts. So in other words, like, we're never happy with our own mind as it is, maybe to an extent because we're conditioned by expectations of that other people have for us, and therefore then we have for ourselves. You know, we're never happy because, you know, I want to be like the way people think I should be, you know, or, you know, and with the mind of Buddha, there's no need to munch on the food of other people's thoughts or how they think. It no longer has that effect on you. So that's how I interpreted it initially.
Yeah. Thank you. I think I have no quarrel with that interpretation. One of the teachings of Darlene Cohen, who's a priest who died a few years back, but was a good friend, was, let others be others. And that's a wonderful teaching. And I think that's what you're referring to is that we get in other people's business, because we think the way they're thinking is off, you know, or I would never think that way. Well, okay, so what? You know, that person thinks that way, and we can, that doesn't mean we can't question people, but about their thinking, but you know, but it just means we have to be careful, and we have to be careful, like, of thinking my way of thinking is better than that person's way of thinking about this. And if we have that kind of thought, then we better confess that right at the beginning. First, we just say, I have a thought that my way of thinking about what you're thinking about is better than the way you're thinking about it.
Or the reverse, Jim. Or the reverse. you know, their way is better. You know, what are they doing? I want to be like them. I want to, you know, so let me eat some of their grass so I can be, so I can have, you know, so both, it works both ways, I think.
That's true. Will?
I'm glad we stopped to ask questions about this story before I go on to the next one. But with the line, riding the ox, searching for the ox, could it also be interpreted as instead of searching, examine?
Sure. Yeah. I think it could be, it could be interpreted that way. It could be interpreted as, you know, investigate. Yeah. Examine, riding the ox, investigate the ox, get to know the ox, get friendly with the ox, learn how to harmonize, you know, be, don't think of yourself as just, here's an ox, I'm riding him, I get to do what I want, you know, and he gets, you know, and I'll make him do what he's going to do, you know, what I want him to do. Yeah. So I think multiple ideas of being friendly, you know, with our stubborn, you know, and kind of even dropping like the idea of stubbornness or willfulness and just say, this is how things are appearing right now. And I know that they won't always appear this way. That's one of the, you know, the impermanence has, you know, it has its downsides, but it has its upsides too. It has a big upside, which is that if you're feeling low or you're feeling confused or feeling, you know, an inability to kind of come into your body and mind in sitting meditation, well, understanding that as an impermanent feeling and thought and state of being is actually, you know, a very, you know, that's a helpful aspect of impermanence. Oh, this is just the way things, you know, we could say, well, and I don't like it, you know, I don't like it, and I don't like the way this is appearing right now. And, you know, we can notice that too. But, you know, it's not the end of the world not to like a certain state of being that you find yourself in. And, you know, just, but even your not liking will change because the state that you're going to, you find yourself in is going to change. It's nothing stays. And there's a relief in that. Sometimes for the, no, anyway, that leads towards health and healing.
It helps to remind myself when I get there to think that way.
Kenny?
I just want to stick up for oxen. I had to do something when my son stayed overnight at Sutter's Fort. I had to study oxen. I don't know, the U.S. ones, they're neutered bulls, but they don't seem to be stubborn as much as kind of big and dumb and, you know, very strong. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes when I'm sitting doing meditation, I feel like I'm on the back of a horse, or really, I really am riding something because I kind of move around a little bit. It's kind of a gentle ride. So it's almost like it's a pretty good analogy to be riding an ox sometimes. And that's all I had say.
Yeah, I remember a talk my teacher gave once. It was about riding a horse, and I guess there's a phrase in equestrian circles, and the phrase is sit the horse. So this is a little piece of meditation instruction, you know, sit the horse. And when you really sit the horse, and because when you really sit the horse, you feel what the horse is doing. You know, you're not just sitting on, it's, the phrase isn't sit on top of the horse. That's not the phrase. The phrase is sit the horse. So it's more direct, and it's more, you know, with the animal being, you know, you want the animal to respond to you, but you need to, if you really want to have a good ride, you need to be responsive to the animal as well. Yeah. So there's a back and forth, and that's where the harmony of writing comes in. Thank you for that. So are you ready for another story? I promised a story about a donkey, so I have to bring out this one. This is really short, and it's from one of the koans in the Book of Serenity. And I don't want to go into the whole case, but this little aphorism is brought up as a to illustrate a point in the case. And it says, some teacher said this, I can't remember his name, but he says, searching for the donkey while riding on a donkey is one illness. After getting on the donkey, not being willing to get down is also an illness. I laughed when I read I had a belly laugh when I read those lines, you know. And but this is a great story, I think. And I guess I was going to bring up here in my notes, it says I was going to bring up Matsu. Actually, I don't know if I feel like bringing up Matsu right now, but Matsu was Baijong's teacher, and he's famous. His famous teaching was this very mind is Buddha. This very mind is Buddha. So I don't even know why I wanted to bring that up right now, but in any case, to go back to this little story that appears in the Book of Serenity in this one case, searching for the donkey while riding on a donkey is one illness. After getting on the donkey, not being willing to get down is also an illness. So. You know, I don't think this is like an answer to Baijong or something like that about, you know, what it means to sit on a beast of burden while searching for a beast of burden. But I think it does go to what we were just talking about, which is that, and I think the point that he's trying to make is, this teacher was trying to make in that little phrase is to think that the mind and the environment are separate, you think that self and other are separate, to think that to think that what we're doing in sitting meditation is trying to control, you know, to trying to control the mind, and to feel that the way to do that is to, you know, stay in the sit separately on the donkey and making the donkey do what we want it to do. So that's kind of off, you know, and it also expresses, I think what he's trying to point to is this idea of a feeling of, you know, there's two there's two things happening, right? There's somebody here trying to get a hold of the mind, and there's a mind that's trying to either be got a hold of or not be got a hold of. But anyway, there's two. And then, so that's a mistake to think it's like that to think that what we're doing is in sitting meditation is a kind of command and control operation. Yeah, that would be not the way I've been told and taught and understood and experienced, actually. Although it can, our meditation can feel like that. It definitely can feel like that. Like, I gotta get a hold of this mind. I got to, you know, I really want to. Or I can't. It's taking me, it's running away with me. It's I'm powerless, you know. So anyway, there's this gap, right? There's this gap. And we don't like the gap. So then we sit on the ox and we sit on the ox and we arrive home and the gap closes. And now mind and self, and there's this great feeling of integration and oneness. And now we don't want to get off of the ox. Or the donkey. This is the donkey. Sorry. This is the donkey. We don't want to get off. I want to stay here in bliss land with, you know, one with everything. Yeah. You know the joke about the Dalai Lama, right? Goes to the hot dog vendor and asks him to make him one with everything. Oh, you've heard it before. Anyway, so that illness, you know, this, it's called an illness in this story. That illness that affects people who, you know, really do a lot. It's not as common an illness. It's kind of a rare illness. It happens more to people that do a long retreats, a lot of long retreats, and or, you know, do, you know, some really, you know, vigorous retreat practice, or live in the monastery for a very long time, and then, you know, they just want to stay there, and they just want to stay in that state of unity, and they don't want to leave it. And then it's kind of being, you know, a bit addicted to bliss and joy. But what happens then, or why that isn't recommended for bodhisattvas? I mean, it is recommended for some meditators. That's a recommended place to go and stay. Just go over there and stay in bliss land. That's what's recommended. But it's not what's recommended for bodhisattvas, unfortunately. We are on a different path. And what's recommended for bodhisattvas is not to get stuck in bliss land. So, you know, the good news, this is kind of a rare illness, and it's usually very, very temporary. You get stuck there for a little while, but, you know, it throws you out pretty quick. So you don't stay there. My teacher likes to warn of this this pitfall of the path with a corny joke. Do you know the words? We chant the harmony of difference and unity, right? And you know that the Japanese word is sandokai. And san literally means three, and do means one, and kai is like merging or harmony, right? So multiplicity and one merging. So my teacher likes to say this thing about warning about not being willing to get down from the donkey. He says, don't get stuck in dough. He loves that joke. I've heard him tell it so many times. Don't get stuck in dough. Don't get stuck in one. Yeah. Anyway. So, oh, Rollin has a...
Yeah, Tim, I like that joke. I hear both stories in as somewhat reassuring to me that that not only don't get stuck in one, but it's impossible to get stuck in one, and that we need to be just forgiving and accepting of the fact that we flow back and forth. Mostly in the multiplicity and the struggles and the strum and the drang, and we try to flow back to more oneness. But the nature of being human is that we sometimes choose to get off the donkey or we get thrown off the donkey, but there's no staying on the donkey. And when I hear that, I feel reassured. And the first story that's why I love to hear the different interpretations from everybody this morning, because I love the Dogen quote about, I only understand as far as my eye of practice can reach. When I heard the first story, where my eye of practice was reaching, was it just was reminding me how often I spend looking for it over there. And it was nice to be reminded that there was no there, it was here. I was riding the ox, but the reality was, part of being human is I'm going to be riding the ox sometime and recognize that I'm home. And just as soon as I recognize it, I'm going to be drawn over there, and that I don't want to aspire to only be here. I can't. I'm human. So I'm here and I'm there. And when I'm there, I remind myself, gee, you better try to get back home. And so it goes.
Yeah, thank you, Roland. One of my first teacher was Richard Baker Roshi, and he was Reb's teacher. Well, not really. Suzuki Roshi was Reb's teacher, but anyway, Suzuki Roshi was Baker Roshi. I think I just completely lost that thought. What was I going to say? He had some teaching that he gave about not, you know, being stuck in one side or the other, essentially. The thing, I know what he was going to say. You see, if you keep vamping long enough, you remember what you were going to say. He said, just don't compare. And he said that quite a few times. And I think that's such a valuable teaching. Just don't compare to, you know, your experience now to an experience you had, you know, last week, and to avoid comparing is that in itself is hard to do. I mean, that's a hard practice to undertake, but it's a valuable as a mindfulness note to see how many times we are comparing, you know, that we're comparing the state we have now to a state that we wish we had or we had before, you know. The Song of the Jewel Marius Samadhi says, the ideal meets the actual like a box and lid fit, you know, and that's you know, that's what you're talking about, the ideal and the actual. Let those integrate. Just don't compare. Brendan.
Yes, thank you, Jim. I always appreciate the these stories, so it was nice to hear some of them. I also appreciate that you brought in Baijan into our conversation today with his emphasis on work, since it is International Workers' Day.
That's right.
May Day. But I was thinking, as we were talking about these beasts of burden, I was thinking about how human beings can be, you know, we are beasts of burden in a way. And I was, my mind was brought to this, these lines from a poem by Emerson. The horseman serves the horse, the neat herd serves the neat, the merchant serves the purse, the eater serves his meat. 'Tis the day of the chattel, web to weave.
Did Brendan freeze to you or just to me?
Yeah, he just froze.
Yeah. Brendan, you
frozen to us.
Yeah, you might have to log back in. If you could do that quickly, we could hear the end of the, we hear the poem. But we can't see you. You're going to have to go out and come back, I think. Oh dear.
Oh boy.
You can't hear us. Okay, well, that's unfortunate. He went away. Let's wait a second and see if Brendan comes back, and I could admit him again, and we can try to hear the poem again.
Yeah, that would be good.
You know, I was thinking we could have had this sitting at the Dharma Center.
I was going to email you that last night, but it was like, well, what's the point?
It's
too late to change anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, 10 or less. We sure could have.
10 or less. We could have done it. So maybe the next time we have, you know, we'll have a sitting, you know, of 10, we could say the first 10 that sign up can come to the Dharma Center, and the next 30 people will have to watch from home.
Well, they'll have an opportunity, Jim.
Maybe that would get us 10 people anyway.
Yeah, they'll have an opportunity this Thursday.
That's assuming that being live is an incentive to people.
Yeah, right. Oh, I don't see Brendan trying to get back. I don't see a request to come back yet.
It may take him time to reboot. He may be rebooting his whole computer for all we know.
Yeah, I have had that experience. I've fortunately never had it on a Sangha event, but I've had that where something just throws me out of the... Well, actually, I have had it in a Sangha event, but...
Internet has been going down across the county, actually.
Oh, has it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I had a poem too. I was going to end with a poem, so maybe I'll end with this poem. It's just a part of a poem, but it's kind of this is a poem. This is part of a poem that was read. And oh, there's Brendan. Never mind. I'll say the poem some other time. You have the floor, Brendan.
Oh, thank you.
Start at the beginning, please.
Sure. My internet cuts out sometimes, and so thank you. I'll just read that section one more time. I'm not sure where I cut out, but Emerson wrote, "The horseman serves the horse, the neat herd serves the neat, the merchant serves the purse, the eater serves his meat. 'Tis the day of the chattel, web to weave and corn to grind, things are in the saddle and ride mankind. And so I was going to comment that I think Emerson, when at the time when he wrote this, was thinking about how material objects were sort of proliferating in his time, and they were becoming more of a materialistic society with all these tools and things. But I was thinking about how we can think of it in terms of all the things that we sort of put in the saddle and that end up riding us. How much of the 10,000 things are we sort of carrying, and how does that make us beast of burden? And I was thinking about how maybe the ox and the donkey, they're not so much stubborn as they're just carrying us and all of our things, you know, and we're just weighed down. And so I remember that quote from long ago, and it just kind of came into my mind. But yeah, I appreciate the stories. They really gave me something to think about.
Thank you. Well, I was just going to end with a poem myself. This poem came to mind. It's a poem from long ago, and it's just part of a poem. Shalema's coming back. Shalema had a docus on it during the lecture, so she had to leave. Shalema, back. We're just at the end of the Dharma talk, Shalema. That's all right. I know you had docus on with Zenju, which was, that was priority. I was just going to read a poem I was explaining was written on January 1, 1983 at Tassajara by a good monk friend of mine. And this is the beginning of the poem. I don't know if it really makes that much sense in this context, but I thought of the poem in relation to an aphorism that I told Kenny a little while ago. And this aphorism also has to do with horses. This has to do with horses and donkeys. And this Zen aphorism is, the horse arrives before the donkey leaves. The horse arrives before the donkey leaves. So, you know, the import of that aphorism is that, you know, we carry a lot of ancient twisted karma, and we're going to spend at least this lifetime, if not many lifetimes, working it out. And so that's going to be something that's the donkey is always going to be with us. But that doesn't mean that the horse won't nevertheless arrive. The horse can arrive, and the horse arrives on the back of our practice. The horse arrives on the back of our practice, or we ride the horse into, and this is the poem, the gray horse dances out of the eastern pine trees, pulling the old broken down carriage. Across the valley, a shiny chestnut brown streaks into the mist, covering the mountains of the west. I think I might have left out a word there. Across the valley, a shiny chestnut brown horse, I think, streaks into the mist, covering the mountains of the west. The horse arrives before the donkey leaves. This is the good news today. Please continue your practice.